This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The video game business is built on sequels and franchises. Grand Theft Auto 4, Rock Band 2, and endless iterations of Super Mario Brothers and Madden Football. Today, gamers can fire up their PlayStations and Xboxes with a franchise that is 700 years old. NPR's Laura Seidel reports on the video game Dante's Inferno.
First, the Cliff's Notes. The Inferno is a 14th century Italian poem by Dante Alighieri. In it, Dante imagines himself taking a journey through the depths of hell.
He's fundamentally mapped hell with this poem.
Jonathan Knight of Electronic Arts is the executive producer of the video game.
He's created a visual topography, and there's a tremendous amount of structure and geography and weather and monsters.
The poem lays out 9 circles of hell. Each circle has souls guilty of a particular sin, lust, gluttony, greed, and so forth. The punishments are symbolic of the sins. Gluttons must lie in slush because of the garbage they made of their lives on earth. Dante is guided through hell by the Roman poet Virgil. By the end of the poem, Dante has a deeper understanding of the Christian idea of sin. But to turn this poem into a video game, producer Knight says his main character had to be more active.
Our reimagined version of Dante is a warrior, he's a fallen crusader, and he's fighting his way through hell.
And doing it for love.
Beatrix!
I have to go with him, my love. I gave my word.
In the game, Dante goes to hell to free his great love, Beatrice. Along the way, he kicks butt, killing suffering souls. This is a far cry from the poem, which is filled with philosophical discussions and monologues about life and death. A few Dante scholars have bristled at the liberties the game takes with the Inferno, but a lot of Dante scholars don't play games. Jonathan Combs Schilling does. He's a 6-year graduate student at UC Berkeley who spends hours hunched over Dante texts, mulling over its intricate meanings. When he relaxes, he enjoys killing monsters, playing his favorite game, God of War. Finally, a game that gives him monsters and Dante.
I mean, he's a poet, and that is his... I'm actually going to find it hard to talk about the cultural worth of Dante while killing these heretics. So, but I will happily get back to that.
Combs Schilling loves certain scenes, like when Dante crosses the river Styx into Hades on the back of the ferryman Charon.
There are a couple moments where the landscape is close to being similar enough to something along the lines of how I had imagined Dante's description, that it's a little bit exhilarating.
Abandon all hope, ye who enter here, is among the most famous lines of the poem, and among the few that actually make it into the game. Combs Schilling says a lot gets lost when you're going from epic poem to video game.
In a certain way, we're not even talking about Dante's Inferno. It's a kind of a mashup of certain aspects of it.
It's part of a long tradition, Combs Schilling points out. Dante's classic poem inspired great works such as the illustrations of Gustave Doré and Franz Liszt's symphony. Combs Schilling thinks making a video game of the poem is like composing music inspired by it.
Because fundamentally, it's not a narrative in the way that a movie or a text, a work of literature, is.
Combs Schilling does have some reservations about the message of the game. Dante justifies a lot of killing to save Beatrice and to eventually redeem himself.
The way the game is structured, you feel okay doing the abhorrent things you do.
Despite the liberties taken by the game, Combs Schilling has no fear that Dante's 700-year-old poem will last and probably inspire many more interpretations. There's also a special print edition of the poem being published with pictures from the game that producers say might draw fans to the original. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Occasionally in this segment, we explore how technology affects the way we relate to each other. All Tech producer Shireen Meraji looks at how technology is changing the breakup just in time for Valentine's Day.
Gigi Quintana is a veteran of breaking hearts in the age of social networking. She recently parted ways with a girlfriend.
It was an 8-month, 9-month relationship.
And says putting an end to their online connection was just as difficult as the breakup itself. Her Facebook status said in a relationship, so she deleted it. But that's not all.
You know, I blocked her sister, I blocked everyone that knew her, and she is still friends with my friend, so I had to go to the extent of blocking her.
Quintana was on a smoke break from her coffee shop job at a place called Trist. It's full of people surfing the net, and quite a few had an opinion about what it's like to break up when you're virtually tied to your ex by Twitter, Tumblr, LinkedIn, Delicious, MySpace, Flickr, Foursquare, and Facebook.
My name's Daisy Montague. An ex-boyfriend contacted me and then wanted to be friends, so then we were friends on Facebook, and then his wife didn't want me to be friends with him anymore.
First name is Omar, last name is Musri. I enjoy not having to tell the entire world your business. One moment. Large skin mocha.
David Muse. If I'm no longer in a relationship with you, I don't need to check up on you. And especially after we break up, why do I need to go and see what you're doing?
Okay, so David Muse may not need to check up on his exes. Not Paul Monday. He's a blogger and avid social networker. And he sums up this digital impulse with the analog phrase, driving by.
Where you don't unfriend, or they have not toned down their privacy settings, and you drive by the other person's profile, and you look at it, and you just, it's basically like stabbing yourself in the heart again every 4 hours or something, you know?
Monday has an ex-wife, an ex-fiancé, and a 9-year-old son, and they're all on Facebook. But they're not all Facebook friends. So when Facebook suggested Paul's son friend his ex-fiancé...
It's sort of like getting hit with a bat to have an ex-fiancé and an ex-wife. Myself, all in this forum centered around my son, was just, I think, too overwhelming for me. And to respect everyone, I actually said no to him.
The absolutely tricky part about this is that it's very hard to unspool these relationships once they have begun without absolutely destroying the digital person that you have become.
Lee Rainey's the director of Pew's Internet and American Life Project. He studies the way the internet affects how we live and relate to one another.
Don't go public with your so-called private life.
Relationship advice guru Judith Martin, better known as Miss Manners, weighs in.
You know, I was talking about this with my daughter, and she said, George Orwell's 1984 has come about, but it's not them doing it to us. It's us doing it to ourselves. We're watching ourselves every minute and posting everything out there. Change your password, folks, and don't go snooping around on the internet on purpose.
21-year-old Kella Vangsness is trying to follow Miss Manners' old-school advice. She recently broke up with her guy and decided to quit Facebook and Twitter altogether to speed up the healing process.
I mean, I can't imagine life without it, but I have been off it for almost a week, and I'm doing fine.
Long gone are the days when you could throw the ex's toothbrush in the trash and burn the shoebox of photo evidence of your once happy coupledom. Shereen Meraji, NPR News. You just keep
me hanging up. Tina Brown, the editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast, has sent us another selection of writings that have grabbed her attention, things she likes to talk about that you may then talk about. We call the series Word of Mouth. The first article on your list here of books and articles for us to check out is called America the Miserable.
Yes, it's from The Spectator magazine in the UK, and it's written by a professor of history at Amory, a Brit. And he's commenting about how he finds that compared to the time that he came to America in 1977, when everyone, he said, was cheerful and peppy and purposeful, he now feels that everybody here has really kind of become deflated, the sense of kind of can-do spirit in America has gone, and how very pessimistic about their country they are. And he even cites the success of Avatar, which he says, in its lumbering allegorical style, it depicts an American way of life that consists in equal parts of cynicism, destruction, and a brutal galaxy-encompassing greed. You might think citizens would object to such demonization, but they don't, etc., etc.
I want to challenge a couple of parts of his argument, though. You talk about Avatar making America look bad, but Americans have always argued and debated and criticized their own actions. And he says that part of America's bad attitude is that Americans are cranky about immigrants right now. But Americans have always been arguing over immigrants, and there have always been anti-immigrant groups. It's hard for me to see what's really different in America than 20 or 30 years ago, as he says.
Well, I think one thing that's different is a genuine, real malaise, of course, with unemployment, where people have a lot to be depressed about. It is, in a way, a fashionable thing right now for the sort of thinking classes to write long screeds about how America's power has ended in the world and how America is never going to regain its position against China, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, that's one thing that is different, is the wide public perception of China as the rising power in the world.
Yeah, that is definitely a factor, I think. Of course, you know, being an immigrant myself, I only see how wonderful America is compared to the UK. I mean, in the UK, for instance, I tend to think when I call up, I always hear the rain in their voices. Hello, they say. And I think to myself, I'm so happy that I left. I don't have to hear, hello.
Well, let's go from this article, America the Miserable, to a recollection of a miserable moment in the American economy. Henry Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary, is out with a memoir that you've been reading.
Yes, I have. Well, I read the extract in the Wall Street Journal on Saturday, which was the section about Mr. McCain comes to Washington. And it really was, I thought, a riveting account. But
let's remember, this seems like 100 years ago. John McCain, in the middle of the presidential campaign and the middle of the financial crisis, said, hold everything, stop the campaign. I want everybody to come to Washington, and we're going to solve this economic crisis right here.
Right. It does seem like a million years ago, doesn't it? There is a great scene in here where McCain finally gets this meeting that he's summoned. And then what Paulson gives is an account how in the meeting with the president and all the players assembled, including Obama, McCain had absolutely nothing to say. It was like, I'm here to stop the fire. Yeah, well, maybe I'll just stand here and wait for a pail. And finally, Obama says loudly after McCain has said, oh, no, I'll wait my turn, etc., I'd like to hear what Senator McCain has to say since we haven't heard from him yet. And Paulson has a comment. He says, as he spoke, I could see Obama chuckling. McCain's comments were anticlimactic, to say the least. His return to Washington was impulsive and risky, and I don't think he had a plan in mind. If anything, his gambit only came back to hurt him, as he was polarized in the press afterwards, and in the end, I don't believe his maneuver significantly influenced the TARP legislative process. Amazing moment in politics, completely subsuming any real care for this crisis that the country was in at the time.
And a revealing moment in this partisan political time where so many people see everything through a partisan lens, that you have a Republican president's Treasury Secretary basically saying John McCain, his fellow Republican, wasn't very bright here, and Barack Obama, although he was being a crafty politician, looked pretty smart.
Exactly right. I think that's what to me is what's authentic about it. It did feel like a real piece of reporting, which I kind of didn't expect from the dome-headed Mr. Paulson.
Well, let's move on to another political memoir of a sort here, Jenny Sanford's book, Staying True. We heard her on the air on Morning Edition earlier this week. You've also been reading her memoir here.
Well, I have, and I have to say that I'm getting increasingly impatient with the Wronged Wives Club. The men they're married to are utter snakes and worms, but these women, they do buy into this stuff, and then they are so humorless about it at the end. I mean, Jenny Sanford's book is such a pious document. At some point, I really wish one of these women would begin their book and say, I'm writing this book out of sweet revenge. My husband was a total worm, and this is payback time.
My husband,
it would be a little more honest. Instead of it's, you know, I'm doing this for the children, I'm doing this because my dignity this, I'm doing this for the political process, or whatever. It is all nonsense. It is about one of two things, money or revenge, very often both.
We're getting word of mouth from Tina Brown, books and articles that have crossed her desk, and they include an article about journalism, which is interesting, Tina, because you've sent us articles that emphasize narrative journalism, long stories in the past, and now you've sent us an article by Michael Kinsley, and the headline is, Cut This Story.
God, I love this piece. This is in The Atlantic, and he writes a piece about how everything is too long and how he says that the demise of newspapers is not fully because of reasons of the economy, etc., but really because newspaper articles are too long.
They're boring.
They're boring. On the internet, news articles get to the point, he says. Newspaper writing, by contrast, is encrusted with conventions that don't add to your understanding of the news. And then he goes on to parse out a paragraph from any kind of New York Times story, which is headed, Sweeping Healthcare Plan Passes House. And the sentence is, handing Obama a hard-fought victory, the House narrowly approved a sweeping overhaul of the nation's healthcare system Saturday night, advancing legislation that Democrats said could stand as their defining social policy achievement.
I'm already asleep.
Exactly right. We keep hearing about bad writing on the internet, but I have to say, writing online is a kind of a truth serum because you really find yourself as an editor saying, forget the throat clearing, get to the point. And actually, it's a very good discipline for writers to remind themselves they're actually talking to readers, and we haven't got the time to sit there for the sort of situational atmospherics.
Although, how do you match that with what you've previously said when you have argued and defended longer journalism with lots of context and novelistic detail and really giving people a picture of things and a sense of the story?
Well, I think narrative should be tight as well. I know when I was writing my book on the Diana Chronicles, I actually knew I had to, from the very beginning, get us into the room with Princess Diana, and then I could, if necessary, backtrack or whatever. But you need to make readers feel that something's about to happen and do it fast.
I'm compelled to mention one other thing, though. Michael Kinsley here critiques a newspaper article that runs to about 1,400 and some words. His own article is 1,809 words by our official count.
It is a long piece, but I've got to tell you that it goes like the wind. And actually, one thing I will say in defense of journalists is nothing is as bad as the kind of prolixus dinosaurus that attacks congressional bills. You know, if all these editors are getting laid off now, let's send them to Washington to edit the health care bill. Maybe somebody can actually read it. You know?
Cut those 2,000 pages down to
20.
Absolutely. Word of mouth from Tina Brown. Tina, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
She's editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast, and we have links to the writing she mentioned at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. Now a bit of sweet advice heading into Valentine's Day. Desserts have come and gone over the years, from Jell-O molds to frozen yogurt and most recently, the cupcake. Well, some foodies say another treat is poised to be this decade's defining sweet. NPR's Netta Ulaby visited one bistro in Alexandria, Virginia that's saying bonjour to the macaroon.
In the kitchen of Restaurant Eve, the cooks are chilling chocolate, proofing bread, and cleaning dill. And one of them is making macaroons.
Whisk it up quickly, but not too quickly.
The executive pastry chef of Restaurant Eve is Ed Holoka. He's blending egg whites and sugar in the service of a dainty French cookie that looks like a fancy little moon pie made with almond flour and flavoring.
It should be crispy on the outside, slightly chewy on the inside, and then it should have just a nice, smooth filling.
A filling cupped by shiny shells of airy meringue. Maybe it's buttercream or jam. Holoka's macaroons look like colorful round pixels of flavor.
Lavender and rosemary, sea salt and olive oil, blood orange pistachio.
Demand for macaroons has spiked in the past few months, says Holoka, a trend noted also by Amanda McClemens on her food blog, Metro Curion.
I've sort of noticed that the macaroon is popping up partout, as they say in France, everywhere.
Everywhere meaning high-end restaurant dessert menus, Starbucks in limited editions, and on the rapidly followed television show, Gossip Girl.
I was in Paris. Only to get your favorite macaroons from Pierre Hermé.
Gossip Girl is kind of putting the macaroon in the spotlight.
McClemon says Gossip Girl just might do for the macaroon what Sex and the City did for cupcakes. It seems that every slightly risque New York-style-obsessed show needs a signature treat.
I think especially for young kind of trend watchers, this has certainly been put in the forefront of their minds that what's a macaroon and where can I get one?
For some people, it's not cool enough just to eat macaroons. They have to make them.
All right.
That's why one cute young couple have come to the industrial steel kitchen of Washington, D.C.'s St. Regis Hotel for lessons on making macaroons.
Macaroons are the fashionable snack. So we're trying to get ahead of the curve on that.
Donald Stevens is a casual cook, like most of the students in the sold-out class. And they all need lots of coaching from executive pastry chef Fabrice Bendano.
You know how to hold the piping bag?
No.
All right, so we're going to use
your right hand all the way on top.
Okay.
Small portions. Small portion.
The technique eludes 26-year-old Lindsay Einstein, who's been trying unsuccessfully to make macaroons at home.
Mine look like blobs of toothpaste, and his look like pink silver dollars.
In fact, after getting schooled in macaroons' intimidating secrets, like drying the almond flour and sugar together in advance and tempering the egg whites, Donald Stevens says maybe the cupcake needn't feel too threatened by the macaroon.
It seems very complicated to prepare, so I'm skeptical.
Still, macaroons have hit enough of a tipping point for the French to start mocking our newfound obsession for them. Restaurant Eve's pastry chef, Ed Holoka, says one of Paris's most famous macaroon makers thinks we like them because they look a little like hamburgers.
And he came up with this one macaroon just to kind of make fun of Americans a little bit, which is actually a ketchup macaroon. And he does put a little bit of pickles on it. He did it kind of, I think, as a joke, but it's become this really staple popular macaroon.
Leave it to the French. For Valentine's Day in this country, Holoka suggests sticking to raspberry macaroons, or maybe white chocolate. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
And if you're adventurous, you can find the St. Regis Hotel's recipe for rose white chocolate macaroons at our website, npr.org.